this is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in the digital age. This is episode 27, and today I'm joined by Catherine Gines, assistant professor of philosophy at Penn State and founding director of the Collegium of Black Women Philosophers. Her publications include, and I'm going to just quote some of your recent ones, at least assuming your website on Penn State is up to date, Race, Thinking, and Racism in Hannah Arendt's The Origin of Totalitarianism, in Imperialism, Slavery, Race, and Genocide, The Legacy of Hannah Arendt, which was edited by Dan Stone and Richard King from Oxford, that's in 2007, The Ambiguity of Assimilation, commentary on Amon Collins, The Ethics of Assimilation in Symposia on Gender, Race, and Philosophy in Volume 2. We'll post these on the blog. Sex and Sexuality in Contemporary Hip-Hop, in Hip-Hop and Philosophy, Rhyme to Reason, a Series in Pop Culture and Philosophy, and that's published by Open Court in 2005. Sartre and Fanon, which is going to be related to the discussion we have today, 50 years later in Sartre Studies International, Volume 9, published in 2002. But Catherine's joining me today to talk about her inaugural lecture, which she gave last week here at Penn State, and the lecture was entitled Jean-Paul Sartre and His Interlocutors Reconceptualizing European Philosophy. So let me ask you, Catherine, just to start first by telling us a few things about the Collegium of Black Women Philosophers, because you're the founding director of that, and it's a really exciting group of people.
Yes. So the Collegium of Black Women Philosophers was founded in 2007. It's a philosophical organization, and the goals of the organization is basically to help recruit more Black women into the discipline of philosophy, as well as to retain the Black women who are currently in the discipline of philosophy. So there are fewer than 40 Black women in the United States holding a PhD in philosophy and working in the academy, working in an actual philosophy department. And I've noticed, although there have been more Black women earning a PhD in philosophy in recent years, there are also several Black women who are leaving the academy. Mm-hmm. So there's been a retention issue. And so I founded the Collegium of Black Women Philosophers in an effort to retain those of us who are here so that we stay here and kind of are able to move along the track to tenure, as well as to try to recruit more Black women, you know, from undergraduates into graduate schools, get them in a tenure track program. Mm-hmm. So it's set up as a mentoring program. There are at least half of the Black women philosophers who are professors are junior faculty. So they're assistant professors, not yet tenured. Then there are a few who are full professors. There are a few who are associate professors. And so basically we're trying to establish a mentoring program where the, you know, associate professors and full professors are functioning as mentors for the junior faculty members, mm-hmm. and where all of the faculty members are also functioning as mentors for graduate students and for undergraduate mm-hmm. students. The organization features an annual conference that has a keynote speaker every year, and then there's an open kind of call for paper, so there's not a particular theme. Mm-hmm. Of each conference. You know, I accept submissions along a number of different themes. So we usually have between 5 and 8 speakers at each conference. The conferences are free and open to the public, the paper sessions. Mm-hmm. There are also some closed sessions at the conference that include professional development workshops for undergraduate students, for example, workshops on applying to graduate school, mm-hmm. for graduate students, workshops on being a good departmental citizen or going on the job market, things of that nature. So we try to, like I said, just do the best we can to recruit and retain Black women in philosophy.
Yeah, last year's was a great experience for me to attend my first one, and that was really a great experience for me to see the different perspectives and mm-hmm. to see the work that you're doing. Now, there's also something going on with just speaking to the point about mentoring mm-hmm. current faculty. Mm-hmm. We're doing something here at Penn State, right, with that. How is that related to the Collegium?
So the Anna Julia Cooper Fellowship is what you're thinking about. Mm-hmm. And this is something that's coming through the Rock Ethics Center mm-hmm. here at Penn State University with the support of Nancy Tawana and Robert Bernasconi. And basically the Anna Julia Cooper Fellow is a junior faculty member Black woman faculty member who's working toward tenure. Mm-hmm. We bring that faculty member on the campus here at Penn State University to work on a project, either like a book chapter or an article that they want to submit to a journal. Mm-hmm. So they come, they give a presentation of their kind of first draft of the article. Or whatever stage the project is in. They get a lot of feedback from both their audience as well as a few key faculty members on in the department that may be working in the area, you know, depending on what the article topic is. And then they have an opportunity to do revisions to bring that project to completion. And then they will come back for the Collegium of Black Women Philosophers Conference in mm-hmm. April to present the finished product. So they get an opportunity to present, like I said, an earlier version of it. They have a few days to work on campus to do some revisions based on feedback that they've received here. And then they have an opportunity to re-present the project and to also get it published. So mm-hmm. whatever the project is, like I said, it will probably be going in to a collected, you know, volume of essays or submit it to a journal.
Right.
And also while the Anna Gia Cooper's fellow is here, she meets with some of our graduate students so that they can get a sense of, you know, what it's like to be on the track to tenure. You know, so sometimes graduate students think their life is just so difficult and impossible as graduate school. And so it's that gentle reminder that this is preparation for what you will continue to be doing even after you get your PhD.
Exactly. Well, I mean, I think what's really exciting from my perspective is how the Collegium does such a nice job of trying to bring Black women into the discipline, mm-hmm. but that's just the beginning of the story, and that's mm-hmm. just one level of the problem. Mm-hmm. And so to have this next level is mm-hmm. really exciting to see that, you know, once they're in the profession, how do we keep them in and make sure they get tenure.
Right. And the retention and the tenure, right. or even going on to associate, because you have some people who get tenure and they feel like, okay, I've gotten tenure, I'm associate professor, that's it. But really encouraging them, well, no, you know, it's important for you to go on and get full professor and, you know, what that means and how that's important for other people as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it doesn't really, well, I shouldn't say it doesn't matter, but, you know, it would be sad if we were able to recruit Black women into the discipline to get their PhD only for them either not to get tenure or for them to ultimately, you know, leave the academy altogether. Right. So, you know, the hope is that we follow this process through from, you know, undergraduate through full professor.
Right. That's great. I think it's great. And I, you know, that's one of the great things that make me very excited about having you here at Penn State to really see that whole side of what we do really have a leadership role in that. And that's really critical for
us. Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that.
No, it's really important. And so it really brings me to the inaugural presented a kind of vision also of philosophy mm-hmm. and what a philosophy department could be. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was really nice the way that you really invited us and as a department mm-hmm. to think about what philosophy means mm-hmm. now and how what it has meant, mm-hmm. what its history has meant, what it means to do the history of philosophy mm-hmm. in a way that isn't exclusionary and oppressive, but in a way that's open. So maybe you could talk a little bit about your inaugural mm-hmm. In general, and then we can get into some of the other discussions of the sort of questions of community and other kinds of doing history of philosophy.
Okay, so broadly, the kind of overview of the inaugural talk, it's coming out of a project that I'm working on Jean-Paul Sartre and his interlocutors. And so I'm basically looking at the example of Jean-Paul Sartre in terms of his philosophy, his interactions with oppressed persons, whether you're talking about Richard Wright or Aimé Césaire, Frantz Fanon, Léopold Senghor, and what these interlocutors or these interactions with these Black intellectuals, what impact did it have on his philosophy? Mm-hmm. And so Jean-Paul Sartre, I'm attracted to as a philosopher precisely because he takes up issues of anti-Black racism, of anti-Semitism, of colonialism, and slavery, various issues. And so in the talk, I'm really looking at how Sartre came to take up these issues and how his analysis of them became much more nuanced and enriched by his conversations with his Black intellectual mm-hmm. interlocutors. So, in other words, while he may have taken a position against certain forms of oppression, I think his nuanced analysis of oppression and how it's operating was very much informed by mm-hmm. His interaction with the oppressed.
And in what sense, I mean, you have also some critiques of his analysis,
I
right?
Do.
right, of course. And so can you just talk a little bit about how you feel like they were, that his views were influenced, mm-hmm. but also then your critique of his views? Because I, in the paper, as you were laying it out, I was trying, because I'm not really that familiar mm-hmm. with Sartre's specific, you know, mm-hmm. points on that issue, mm-hmm. trying to parse out, okay, what is Sartre sort of getting from his discussions mm-hmm. with Wright and others, mm-hmm. What is, and then on the other side, then what's your critique of that?
Right. Well, the way the paper is laid out, I start off with just some basic kind of biographical facts right. in terms of how, you know, different people came into contact with one another. Richard Wright's visit to France and meeting Sartre and Beauvoir, Beauvoir and Sartre visiting the U.S. Sartre came to the U.S. before Beauvoir, but when she came to the U.S., she actually spent a considerable amount of time with Richard and Ellen Wright while she was uh-huh. here, looking at kind of exchanges in terms of letters or contacts at conferences with right. Fanon and Wright, etc. So that's kind of the first section, is just looking at the biographical facts of those contacts. The second section looks at my critique of Sartre, in particular, his position in Black Orpheus, where he asserts that Black Orpheus is basically a preface that Sartre writes to a collection of Negritude poetry from mm-hmm. Senghor and Césaire. And Sartre is basically taking the position, I mean, there are some positive things in Black Orpheus, but the part that I critique is he makes the argument that basically, the Negritude movement is something that is good for the Negro to acquire a positive race consciousness, mm-hmm. an authentic race consciousness. But once that race consciousness is acquired, then he has to deny this race consciousness mm-hmm. so that he can join the greater class struggle.
Right.
And so ultimately, Sartre is aiming toward a raceless and a classless society. Mm-hmm. And so my argument is that Sartre, as a white Frenchman, is really not in a position to tell the Black colonized that they have to, you know, acquire race consciousness only to reject it so that they can, you know, join the socialist struggle.
Right.
And that's where my critique of Sartre comes in. Now, some people have made the case, well, Sartre is not the only one who's made this argument. They'll point to how, you know, Césaire had actually been a part of the communist movement. And I tend to point out that Césaire also, you know, resigned from the communist movement
right.
precisely because he felt it did not give adequate attention to issues of race within the context of the class struggle. So that's what my critique yeah. is. The Sartre and Fanon 50 Years Later piece that you mentioned earlier
yeah.
takes up that critique, and also this debate between Sartre and Fanon, where Fanon is critiquing Sartre for laying out this position. And again, there are some who say, well, Fanon ultimately agreed with Sartre. He just disagreed with Sartre, you know, coming from the position of white Frenchmen articulating the
right.
ideas that he articulated
right.
there.
I want to just pause a second because mm-hmm. It seems to me that on the one hand the position that you're saying that Sartre takes up,
mm-hmm.
which is that okay, we have to move beyond race, we mm-hmm. have to move to this class consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
At least in what you just said, mm-hmm. and also in your inaugural, you seem to take issue with who was saying that
right.
and not that point, right?
Because,
I mean, I think, in talking also with Robert on the previous episode mm-hmm. of the Digital Dialogue, we were been talking about, you know, the real problem of, you know, trying to think in a kind of colorblind way or mm-hmm. in a kind of beyond race way,
mm-hmm.
right? There's all kinds of ways of criticizing that just as
right.
an idea,
right.
whoever is saying it.
Right.
right. But there's another set of issues which I'm also myself particularly, as a white male, particularly interested in hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Certain arguments coming from certain people mean certain things,
right.
and so I'd like to also have that kind of a conversation
right.
too.
Right. So I see both layers of that, and I disagree with both positions.
Okay.
Right. So I do disagree with the whole argument for the colorblind
right.
post-racial society. I mean, I think.
Right.
I don't know. I think it's, one, not an attainable goal necessarily. I mean, I think that may point to my pessimism about race, but then it's not a desirable goal for
right,
me, right?
Right?
So in other words, I don't think fighting or overcoming racism requires the elimination of racial categories
right.
altogether, right? So for me, racial identity or race consciousness has positive attributes
mm-hmm.
to it. It's about culture. It's about heritage. It's about, you know, celebrations
mm-hmm.
Beyond just racial oppression. So for me, you know, retaining a race consciousness is not only a defensive mechanism against mm-hmm. anti-Black racism, for example. It also has positive positive quality. So even if racism were to disappear tomorrow, I would not advocate for, you know, a raceless society or a colorblind society.
Can we just push that one, mm-hmm. push that point a little bit more? Because then we can go back to the who is saying what, because mm-hmm. I think that's a really important point. If I'm understanding you, well, maybe we need to problematize mm-hmm. the whole, well, I would consider it a kind of enlightenment idea mm-hmm. of equality mm-hmm. and in the sense of sameness, mm-hmm. right? And part of, from my perspective, what's important about whether or not we could get rid of, you know, race consciousness or whatever mm-hmm. is in some sense beside the point mm-hmm. of, as human beings in a pluralistic mm-hmm. world, mm-hmm. we need to cultivate the habits of appreciating, embracing, mm-hmm. reinforcing mm-hmm. difference mm-hmm. and living in the ambiguity that brings mm-hmm. and the ambivalence that brings. So there's, mm-hmm. it, from my perspective, the whole idea that you would want to annihilate difference mm-hmm. in some kind of way would really take a I think one of the main challenges of what it means to be human away from us, mm-hmm. namely, how do we deal with one another mm-hmm. As different? Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you...
I would agree with that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Okay, good.
So. Yeah. Celebrate different.
It's celebrate, but I think when this goes to the whole point I think that you're trying to make about the department here, and mm-hmm. I think about even our conversation mm-hmm. is, yeah, okay, celebrate, that's great, but... Mm-hmm. How do you live it?
Right.
I mean, how do you live in a way mm-hmm. that respects difference mm-hmm. and not just as a kind of, well, yeah, we all are different, but in a way that lives the hard truth mm-hmm. of what difference is, where mm-hmm. we're going to have to make decisions and who has authority and who has control, right. That's all at stake.
Right. Right. I mean, I think this gets to the other portion of the inaugural where I'm looking at Sartre. So although I'm critiquing this position that he takes in Black Orpheus, I'm looking at two specific examples of influences of the Black intellectual interlocutors on Sartre. One being looking at the gaze and then the other being, or even you can look at freedom, the concept of freedom. From being in nothingness to the critique of dialectical reason, which I didn't discuss in the inaugural, but the gaze from being in nothingness to critique of dialectical reason, and then also the his analysis of colonialism as a system.
Right.
So with regard to the gaze and being in nothingness, you have this account of the gaze that's very antagonistic. It's always about, who's going to be the subject, who's going to be the object, you know, and we recognize other human beings insofar as we recognize that they're in a position to also, objectify us with their gaze.
Right.
And for him, the gaze is pretty much reciprocal in being in nothingness. So there's not as much of an account. There's some gesture toward it, but not as much of an account of, you know, how hierarchy or power relations right. plays a role in the gaze. And then when you get to anti-Semite and Jew, which I constantly emphasize is a very controversial text
right.
and has been critiqued by a lot of people. But again, what I like about the text is a more broad analysis, not so much of the specific situation of the anti-Semite and Jew, but of, you know, oppressor oppressed and those power dynamics and how they're operating with regard to the gaze. And so he makes the claim that, the anti-Semite who's in the oppressed position does not have an ontological resistance to the gaze. The Jew doesn't have an ontological resistance to the gaze of the anti-Semite. But then when you get to Black Orpheus, and this is the more positive aspects of Black Orpheus, Sartre is advocating a position in which through negritude, the colonized have reversed the gaze. So they're able to look back at the colonizer in a way that... was not seen as possible, you know, before he reads the negritude poetry. And I do point out that, you know, although he makes the case that, you know, for 1,000 years, the white man has only been a look, he's never been seen. Clearly that's not the case. I mean, you know, white men have been seen over the years, but perhaps not in a way where they actually, you know, felt the gaze, felt objectified by the gaze of the other or saw themselves for the first time in the gaze of the other. And so in Robert Bernasconi, in one of his essays on the gaze that deals with Sartre, talks about how, you know, it's in the process of being completely ignored in negritude poetry. So in other words, you know, what is alarming to, alarming in a positive way to Sartre, mm-hmm. is that the negritude poetry is about the colonized. It's not a bunch of poetry about Europeans or trying to be European or about the oppressor. And it's in being decentered by this poetry that Sartre suddenly experiences himself as white man, as mm-hmm. oppressor, as colonizer, mm-hmm. In a way that, you know, it I think it has a lasting impact on him and kind of shifts his direction in terms of how he takes up the issues of colonialism.
Right. And I mean, but what's interesting in some way is that that experience leads him to a certain kind of position, which mm-hmm. is this annihilation of race
right.
consciousness.
Right.
Rather than, actually, what's more interesting from my perspective mm-hmm. is the... I would consider what's happening there with regard to Sartre the emergence of his own ethical imagination mm-hmm, mm-hmm. in the sense of being able to imagine your way into the position mm-hmm. of another, even if you obviously can't ever mm-hmm. take that over.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the cultivation of an ethical imagination mm-hmm. is a critical in terms of thinking about how we can relate to one another in productive mm-hmm. ways mm-hmm. because. I think what happens is, there's a certain set of lenses that one mm-hmm. reads things through and relates to others through. And to be able to try to get out from underneath that, so that is important.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think sort of the question of the gaze and the logic of the gaze, mm-hmm. Not just the active appropriation, mm-hmm. which is how I think it has historically been understood in terms of the history of European philosophy, mm-hmm. but also there's a dimension of being seen even in seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Even if we do a strong critique of seeing as the model for cognition and the model for philosophy,
mm-hmm.
we might have also still in that metaphor, the visual metaphor,
mm-hmm.
a kind of what I would call a kind of middle voice, namely that you're neither purely active nor purely passive,
right.
but you have this and that's the side that the white male European tradition has denied for
mm-hmm.
itself,
mm-hmm.
that being seen side.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, and I think you continue to see the growth, for example, even beyond, you know, my critique of Sartre and
yeah.
being in Black Orpheus, where he's, you know, calling for this renouncing race consciousness to join the class struggle. But by the time he's writing the preface to Fanon's Wretched of the Earth or Memmi's The Colonizer and the Colonized, there's no longer this call for rejecting race. You know, now there's this presentation of negritude as a warning for the coming, resistance movements, anti-colonial resistance movements in many of France's colonies. And so I think through his conversations with Richard Wright in terms of his framing of not only anti-Semitism, but also colonialism and anti-Black racism more broadly as a white problem and not a Negro problem is, I think, a direct influence from Richard Wright.
Right.
But then also, you know, I think conversations with Fanon and seeing Fanon in the context of other conferences, he was really convinced of just the, you know, the multifaceted layers of
mm-hmm.
the colonial system, you know. So he has these essays where he's arguing that colonialism is a system. He has an essay called, you know, We Are All Murderers, where, you know, he's kind of holding all white Europeans accountable for the colonial system, whether or not they're in the colonies
right.
or whether or not they're, you know, actively supporting the colonies. He's saying they're all benefiting in some way from this colonial system. And so that he was able to listen to and engage his interlocutors in a way that becomes reflected in his changing
mm-hmm.
Evolving attitudes toward colonialism and other systems of oppression is the kind of model that I was hoping
mm-hmm.
to uphold in the lecture and gesture towards in terms of how we as philosophy professors can take different attitudes towards our students. So I think so often, you know, the professor-student model is that the professor holds all of the holds all of the knowledge. The
right.
student is the empty vessel into
right.
which, you know, into whom we pour all yeah. of this knowledge. And so I was really trying to encourage us all to take a moment to see what we could learn from our students
yeah.
as our interlocutors and how our philosophies might be enhanced and how, you know, we may learn different things when we take seriously what our students can contribute, particularly in our department where we have the unique good fortune of having students. We don't have all men in our
right.
department. We have, you know, a
right.
nice balance of male and female students here. We have different races represented, different nationalities represented,
right.
and I think all of these different backgrounds bring unique important perspectives to the discipline, to the department, and we can all learn from each other being in conversation with one another.
Well, that really speaks. There's a couple of issues there that I would love to come back to. So one of which, so remind me, is the white problem versus Negro problem, according to that's a Richard Wright formulation, right? I want to come back to that because it'll probably be related to this. It's related always to this issue of power, authority, and probably ultimately to the history of philosophy and European philosophy particularly. Mm-hmm. But since you brought up the community issue, this is something that I've been really thinking about, particularly with regard to my teaching particularly with regard to sort of my last semester's teaching, which was for me really transformative because I was able to use technology and blogging in a kind of way that was very exciting because I was trying to cultivate a community around the material we were reading in this ancient Greek philosophy class. And what happened was the students really bought into the blog format as a way of talking about real substantive academic issues. And what I found myself in a position of really learning a lot from them because I had opened it up in a way that allowed them to take ownership. Mm-hmm. What ended up happening was I learned, and I was reminded again why I'm in education in the first place, which is because I love to learn and I love to engage students and engage with these ideas. So I think that point that you make is a really important one, namely that we as faculty have to be ready and open to learning from students and their experiences. And I think we do have an opportunity here in the philosophy department, because we do have a diverse graduate student body, to be able to talk to graduate students in interesting ways, both as students and as themselves as teachers. How does one navigate these relationships? How does one try to build community together, not only in the graduate program, but in each one of your classes? You know, that's where, from my perspective, learning happens, in social communities, which is, of course, it's guided by, managed in a certain sense by the faculty, and the faculty does have expertise. That's never a doubt about that. But when some of that authority can be relinquished a little bit, and the students given empowered to do some things, really exciting things can happen. So I really appreciate that point that you're making.
Yeah, I mean, that for me has been influenced. I mean, I can remember my freshman year in college reading the chapter on the banking system of education and pedagogy of the oppressed. And I think that left an impression on me as a student in terms of how I saw my relationships to my professors as a college student and what I wanted to get out of college. And then later, actually more recently, I've read Bell Hooks' Teaching to Transgress, where she's, borrowing some of the pedagogical model from Pedagogy of the Oppressed, but is also, incorporating her own ideas. And I think that, I think people who, there certainly is this power dynamic between, professors and students. Yeah. And of course, that is negotiated differently for different people, depending on the professor and the student, right? And so for white male professors who are thought to embody, especially philosophy professors, when a student walks into a philosophy classroom, they're expecting to see, the graying white male with glasses and a tweed coat, who could have been,
close now.
Before class or, pontificating, whatever. And so it can be very unsettling when the student walks in and there's a woman in the classroom, or a person of color in the classroom, or a woman of color in the classroom, because, already, what they had envisioned in terms of who's the mouthpiece of philosophy, or who is the authority on philosophy, has been unsettled a bit just by the embodiment of the professor in the classroom.
There's a victory right there, in that instance.
Right, so that is right there is a victory. So there's some some shattering of stereotypes and expectations already there, but I think when professors really hold on to this attitude of I am the only authority, there is nothing that I can learn from my students can only learn from me. I think that comes out of the opposite position, right? And so I think when you're holding on to that power and authority so much that you're unwilling to relinquish any of it, that you're unwilling to concede that there's something that your students can contribute to the dialogue, to the discussion, that there's something that your students can contribute to establishing a learning community, I mean, I don't know, that to me seems like a more defensive posture. You know, it's because you feel like you don't have the authority that you claim to have, that you're holding all the more onto onto that authority. And so I think it's the person who really is comfortable with his or her authority and who consciously wants to cultivate a learning community in which always the professor is student and professor and the students are teacher and students.
Right.
So I think there should always be this reciprocity in the classroom in which, you know, we all learn from one another. We all have different perspectives. We all have different interpretations, ways of reading the text, ways of understanding the text. And it's only in a reciprocal learning community that we can kind of maximize what that experience is going to be inside the classroom and also model it outside of the classroom.
Well, I mean, the connection now is becoming clear to me between this position that you're taking, which is, it seems on one hand, a pedagogical perspective position, namely, you know, learning happens in communities. How do we cultivate these communities in classrooms? And what is the role of the professor, teacher in that context? And the critique that you level against the history of philosophy. Right? So because the question really is, you know, what is involved in the name philosophy and the privileging of a certain group of people as, you know, this is really philosophy, whereas that over there is really not philosophy.
And
the defense of that rigid kind of boundary, I think, is also rooted, as you're saying, in a kind of ultimate insecurity in authority. And what would, but on the other hand, you know, I think philosophy also has, in its tradition, has a lot of resources for us to help us think about another possibility, right? Where, and I'm thinking particularly from my perspective with regard to the Platonic dialogues and the way context and embodiment, you know, are taken seriously if you read the dialogues in a certain way. And if you read them in another kind of canonical way, they also perpetuate a certain kind of oppression and all that. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your critique of the history of philosophy, the critique, and then also maybe we could talk about the teaching of it, since it is something that's important to me, kind of.
Well, in the inaugural lecture, I looked at the example of just how the typical story that's told about the history of philosophy, where, you know, it starts with ancient Greeks, with Thales, you know, and goes onward from there with, you know, mostly white, mostly male European philosophers. And so in the inaugural, I looked at some of the texts that call into question these kind of ancient Greek origins of philosophy, making the case that philosophy has other origins. The texts I look at in the inaugural have to do with Egyptian influences on philosophy. And then I also looked at, you know, when you look at a lot of history of philosophy textbooks, so when I look at, you know, most of the books that I have that are kind of, you know, history of philosophy readers, you know, the overwhelming majority of the philosophers contained in the books are going to be, you know, going from the Greeks, European philosophers. You have a few that may take into account Asian philosophy, looking at like Confucius and Buddhism. You have a few that may take into account Indian philosophy, looking at like Vedic writings and the Upanishads. And then a few that will have, you know, one or two readings on what they'll call African thought, right? And these are always called, you know, like they don't get the same, even within the philosophical text, you know, it's like Asian thought or Indian thought or African thought, but they're not accorded the same title of philosophy. And so there's a way in which, you know, the canon has been constructed, but then also the readers that we use to teach our students are constructed in a way that forecloses the possibilities of anybody being a philosopher, but, you know, the Greeks kind of spreading their knowledge to the Germans, the French, the British, and then it coming over to the United States without any regard for the continent of Africa or Asia or, you know, the Americas independent of the U.S. And so what I am suggesting is that we not that we stop teaching Greek philosophy, obviously, but that we take seriously that there are other philosophies out there. There are other peoples, there are other continents, other nations that are engaging in philosophical questioning, inquiries, etc., some of which predate, you know, the story of the ancient Greek philosophers. And so, yeah, I mean, I do think there is a defensive posture around that, you know, because there's a certain identification with, you know, the quote unquote canon. And, you know, Bell Hooks points out in the Teaching to Transgress book, you know, the choice that one makes to only teach white male philosophers in a classroom is at the end of the day a political choice.
Yeah.
And so how do we, I mean, and I'm not recommending that we teach everything. I mean, you can only fit so much into, you know, a 16-week or a 14-week semester. But I think it is important to at least recognize that this is one version of a story. You know, this is not the only story to be told, and at least let students know, even if you're not well versed in, you know, African philosophy or like I said, Indian philosophy, Chinese philosophy, whatever the case may be, at least acknowledge for the class that these things exist, as opposed to, you know, denying that there is anything outside of this very narrowly defined canon.
And I think there's a way in which, you know, what you're also pointing to is how the question of how these canonical figures are taught. I mean, there's a way in which you could teach the canon that reinforces and reinvigorates the aura of the origin of philosophy in this, you know, sanctified Greek moment or whatever, right? But there are other ways that one could teach even those texts that call into question the creation of the aura of an origin, authoritative origin in that way. And the whole question of how, you know, looking at some of these texts that ask about, you know, authority and government and politics and how that's established and thinking self-critically and reflectively on, well, okay, how does that apply to these texts also, right? So I do think that what's, you know, of course, my education of a lot of people didn't include the kinds of texts that you're talking about, right? So but that doesn't mean that, first of all, we can't learn those texts, but second of all, that we can't teach the canonical texts in ways that don't reinforce that exclusionary, oppressive kind of structure.
Right. And I think, I mean, I think that is a very good point. I think a lot of philosophy professors tend to avoid that discussion altogether. Yeah. So they continue to teach the canonical texts and, you know, in a particular way and completely ignore, you know, some of the issues that are already raised in the text or try to depoliticize the text in certain ways that become problematic. Yeah. And, you know, again, I think a lot of that has to do with a kind of defensive posture, not wanting to, I don't know. I mean, it's as if you bring up the issue of, you know, sexism for a particular philosopher, the issue of racism for a particular philosopher. I think some professors are so personally identified with that philosopher that a critique along the lines of racism or sexism is internalized as a critique of them and their own work, not of the particular figure that they're reading. And in some cases, that critique may apply to their own work as well.
Sure.
But being willing to, you know, engage in those questions, I think, you know, I mean, that is what philosophy is supposed to be about, right?
But
this
is
why they wanted to kill Socrates, because he pissed people off,
Well,
no, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that. He,
you can,
he angered
you can.
And
no,
infuriated.
No, you can. We'll just put the explicit bar. No, piss people, that's not the but what's really powerful about what you're suggesting is, from my perspective, is, okay, to do that, to be open, to teach in a way that is not oppressive or that is open to being questioned or to, that doesn't construct an aura of authority around it, that is sort of grounded in it, the authority of the ideas and the interests of those ideas, to teach that way and to live the way that we've been talking, namely, in an open way that's not defensive, that's not insecure with one's own ground, let's say, just to use that kind of language, requires the cultivation of certain habits, and both intellectual and practical. And that's something that, you know, we need to think about as teachers, not only of philosophy, but I think as teachers in general. Are we cultivating those things in our students? Are we modeling for students how to be disagreed with and without, like, crumbling or getting upset or angry and closing off? You know, those kinds of what I would call excellences, and I think of those as kind of dialogical excellences, namely, can we, is there a kind of openness? Do you have the imagination to see the position, even if you don't agree with it, right? And to see the different sides of something, to live in ambiguity in a certain kind of way. I mean, I think cultivating those habits and those excellences is critical to education, but also to politics and to having a kind of community, be it small or large, that is functioning and nurturing, as opposed to dysfunctional and mm-hmm. competitive and destructive, mm-hmm. really. And I wonder if there are ways, and I think you do it nicely in the inaugural too, to model ways of reading. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're putting Sartre in conversation mm-hmm. and taking the all of the ideas seriously mm-hmm. models that. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
Yeah. Can we go, because I know we only have a little bit of time, at least I do, and you do, I know, too. I want to go back to the white problem, Negro problem.
Right, right. So in the 1940s, when Richard Wright makes his visit to France, and he's arriving in France, one of the French reporters asks him, well, tell me about the Negro problem in the United States. And Richard Wright replies, there isn't a Negro problem, there's a white problem.
Right.
And, basically his position is that the issue of anti-Black racism is a white issue, and when white people are able to let go of their racism, when they're willing to let go of their kind of the stereotypical mythical image of the Black person, of the Negro, then, you know, the Negro problem will cease to exist. Mm-hmm. And this is something that's also taken up by Myrtle in An American Dilemma. And Myrtle's a European intellectual who came over to the United States and, again, has a number of Black interlocutors, particularly social scientists, and does this massive two-volume study on, kind of race issues in the United States. And he also, you know, comes to the conclusion that, you know, racism in the United States is not a Negro problem, it's a white problem. And so Sartre cites this mm-hmm. at the end of Anti-Semite and Jew and the conclusion, basically saying, you know, anti-Semitism is a white European problem, it's an anti-Semite problem, it's not a Jewish problem. And then he also reiterates it in other places, like in What Is Literature, right. And and the sentiment is operating certainly in his analysis of colonialism and other places. And so, yeah, so again, the idea is that, you know, anti-Black racism is something that has been created by white people. And even if you brought Fanon into the conversation, there's this whole discussion in Black Skin, White Mask in particular of this dialectic between the Negro and the white man. It also operates in The Wretched of the Earth, but this idea that the colonizer creates the colonized, that mm-hmm. the Negro is this product of the white imagination, that the white person projects all of his issues onto so that he can kind of justify the subjugation of the colonized or of the slave or whatever the case may be. And so, you know, this is what one of the great lessons, I think, that Sartre gets from both right in the context of the Negro problem, white problem, but also from Fanon in the context of colonized or colonized.
So how does that set of ideas, mm-hmm. which I think is really important, and it's really important for someone like Sartre to mm-hmm. to come to that recognition. I think mm-hmm. it's important for white males in general to
right.
come to that, to come to see that.
Mm-hmm.
But how does that play then into this whole question of
philosophy?
Yeah, not only philosophy, but sort of, you know, what is, just to put it in terms of our relationship and our conversation, what is my role as a
mm-hmm.
white male in terms of trying to undermine and advocate for and dismantle a kind mm-hmm. of structure
mm-hmm.
that I clearly benefited mm-hmm. from just by virtue of how I was born,
right?
You know, versus, you know, your role mm-hmm. as a Black woman mm-hmm. in the academy, and how can we work together in a certain kind of way? I mean, there's certain things that I shouldn't be saying or
right.
thinking or doing that you can say and think and do.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other things that maybe that I should be doing that maybe I'm not doing. So,
well, I think, again, looking at the model of Sartre, right? So Sartre does not, even though I do critique the position of Black Orpheus, in general, he's able to kind of focus his attention and his comments on what his role as a white European male is, or
right.
what he can do as a white European male, as opposed to saying, you know, well, this is what the colonized need to do,
right.
or this is what
right.
the oppressed need to do. And so I think following that model is, you know, taking seriously, you know, as you said earlier, how you're going about teaching philosophy
right.
courses, right? So how do you reinscribe, you know, this kind of power dynamic or hierarchy in the way that
right.
you're teaching philosophy classes, and how can you kind of make shifts in your syllabus or in your approach to teaching that would encourage a more inclusive
mm-hmm.
version of philosophy. I mean, I think another thing that goes on in the classroom in particular is you have students who may raise issues around like I said, the sexism or the racism, right. or, you know, was this philosopher involved in, you know, the Holocaust right. or Nazism right. or whatever the case may be. And instead of just shutting that out to say, oh, well, you know, that's personal, that's not philosophical, right. or this is outside of the realms of, you right. know, our philosophical inquiry, take seriously, you know, that the student wants to raise it as an issue mm-hmm. because it is an issue. But then also take seriously, okay, what import do, you know, these other aspects of this philosopher have for, you know, their system of philosophy, because oftentimes these are not these appendages that are, you know, completely disconnected from their right. philosophical thinking. Right. A lot of times you can trace that sexism across mm-hmm. their work. You can mm-hmm. trace that racism across the work. So I think if we are open to the possibility of taking seriously those types of critiques, then it will help to, you know, to cultivate that environment. And then also encourage the students to engage in certain right. inquiries, because I think when the student is just shut off as, you know, right. well, that's irrelevant. Right. Why are you even raising this as an issue? Then I think that can have an impact on the student and how they go about doing philosophy mm-hmm. Or call into, you know, obviously they're raising the question because it's important to them. But when the professor cuts them off in that way, then, you know, it starts to undermine their, right. you know, confidence in right. themselves or prevent them from pursuing the questions that are, mm-hmm. you know, of serious interest to them.
I mean, and so what you're, I think, articulating mm-hmm. is something that I really strongly believe, which is that philosophy isn't just an academic discipline. Mm-hmm. It really is an activity. It's a living activity. Mm-hmm. And so what counts as philosophy and philosophical questions, mm-hmm. really, that is quite fluid mm-hmm. and often quite uncomfortable sometimes.
Right, right.
But that's part of living a philosophical life, right. is facing those things mm-hmm. in ways that are not, that don't close things off, that don't delimit in rigid ways mm-hmm. that block, mm-hmm. but actually invite in ways that might open new possibilities. Mm-hmm. And I think that those are that's the vision of philosophy mm-hmm. that I want to try to live, not right. just write about. I mean, I also want to write right. about it and right. research it too.
But. Well, I mean, I think the other thing is that these are all aspects, they're always already a part of philosophy, right. right? So there are some philosophers who pretend that, like, somehow in the last 20 years or so, you know, some people have infiltrated the discipline and raised all of these issues about embodiment right. and race and gender right. and class. And that's not the case. You right. know, these are not questions right. that are being imposed from the outside. These are questions that are always already a part of the discussion right. throughout even the narrow canon sure. that we consider. They're already even a part of that canon, let alone, right. you know, when you broaden the canon right. and incorporate other voices right. into it. And so there's a sense in which, you know, the narrow-minded philosopher is denying, you know, the very activity that they claim to be engaged in, exactly. which is philosophical inquiry.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, this has been really very exciting. I love the inaugural. I really thank you for coming on the Digital Dialogue.
Thank you very much.
And I look forward to more conversations in the future.
Oh, wonderful. Thanks yeah. for having me.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You'll find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/CPL2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of The Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for The Digital Dialogue. This has been The Digital Dialogue.